Chapter 3, Sugar, by Khalil Gibran Muhammad. On the banks of the Mississippi River, a few dozen miles west of New Orleans, rusted sugar mills dot the fertile landscape of southern Louisiana. Rising high above the country roads bordered on two sides by dense foliage, the mill smokestacks stand tall like rounded obelisks, monuments to Queen Sugar's regal history. Most of the plantation houses and fields that once fed these mills are less visible. They are concealed down long driveways, hidden behind thick underbrush and trapped in a false memory of the past. The Whitney Plantation is different. It sits on the northern edge of St. John the Baptist Parish, once home to dozens of thriving sugar plantations. But unlike the others, it beckons to passers-by. When you approach the place at the edge of a gravelly entrance, a bright white sign with red lettering announces the story of slavery. Framed by lush trees in need of trimming, the Whitney Plantation's main residence, where generations of owners once lived, is a French colonial structure built for the tropical climate. Its wide-hipped roof overhangs a two-level wraparound porch that offers maximal shade. Louvered doors and window shutters abound, a means of managing the insufferably hot, sticky air. Nine columns stand squat across the front of the house, seeming to reach deep down into the soil, like anchors to keep the Atlantic hurricanes from washing it into the waters from whence its enslaved workers originally came. The rear of the house opens to a green expanse where all is visible. The first structure you see is the main kitchen, a detached building 200 feet to the right of the house. Down a bit farther are a mule barn, a blacksmith's shop, the machinery of sugar making, and a half dozen slave quarters that resemble the dilapidated shotgun homes of New Orleans' Lower Ninth Ward, except without paint. From the enslavers' bedroom windows, the Whitney's cane fields stretch out to the horizon. Before the Europeans arrived, all of this land was home to Taensa Indians. German farmers began showing up in 1719, after which the area was called the German Coast, because unlike most of the earliest colonial settlers to Louisiana, these particular newcomers were not French. The Whitney Plantation was built in 1752. From its rich soil, enslaved Africans, many of whom were from Senegambia, cultivated corn, indigo, and rice until sugar took over at the turn of the 19th century. The Whitney operated continuously until 1975. Today it is a museum, but unlike many plantation museums in the South, this one is designed not to glorify a past of putatively genteel masters and mistresses, but to educate visitors and offer them a chance to bear witness to the exploitation and extraction that are the foundation of our modern world. What little Americans are taught or think they know about the slavery-based economy is largely a success story of how cotton became the nation's leading export in the 19th century. Some people might also think of tobacco as a cash crop worked by enslaved people in places like Virginia in earlier eras. But even though cotton and tobacco dominated the colonial American economy, it was sugar that anchored the economy of the larger Atlantic world from the 16th century onward. Sugar slavery, which was uniquely destructive and deadly, made Brazil the focal point in the triangular trade in the century before 20 to 30 Africans landed in Point Comfort, Virginia in 1619. Until then, European colonists had considered North America little more than an afterthought. White gold, as sugar was called, drove trade in goods and people, fueled the wealth of European nations, and for the British in particular, shored up the financing of the North American colonies. Over the span of nearly 300 years, from the mid-16th century on, a succession of European nations, Portugal, Spain, the Netherlands, France, and Britain, plied an international slave trade with African elites and dealers on one side of the ocean and an insatiable demand by white colonists for enslaved labor on the other. It is not an overstatement to say that the crop they produce changed the world. Cane stalks still grow at the Whitney Plantation Museum, as they do on nearly every speck of fertile ground as far as the eye can see, a lush green testament to the unquenchable taste for the plant's sweet juice. The Whitney's tiny annual crop, which helps pay the museum's bills, is an infinitesimal portion of U.S. domestic sugar production, which itself is but a portion of a global sugar industry that produces some 200 million tons per year. The world's leading sugar producer is Brazil. The United States ranks fifth in global production, with about 9 million tons annually. Domestically, the sugar produced from sugarcane and sugar beets remains one of the country's most important agricultural products. Louisiana's sugarcane industry is by itself worth $3 billion, generating an estimated 16,400 jobs. As important as sugar has become to American agriculture, it's had an even bigger impact on the American diet. Some 73 pounds of sugar and related sweeteners, such as high fructose corn syrup, are consumed per person per year, according to United States Department of Agriculture data. That makes us the biggest per capita consumers of sugar in the world. Those 9 million tons we grow each year aren't nearly enough to meet our demand, so we import an additional 3 million tons annually. And sugar is no average foodstuff. What was once a luxury to adorn the lavish banquets of elites has become a toxic foodstuff for the masses. America's high rate of sugar consumption is a major factor in our poor national health. The average American's sugar consumption is nearly twice the limit the USDA recommends based on a 2,000-calorie diet. And sugar has been linked in the United States to diabetes, obesity, and cancer. Over the last 30 years, the group of Americans who are obese or overweight grew 30% among all adults to 73% from 56%, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. During the same period, diabetes rates overall nearly tripled. But if sugar is killing all of us, it is killing Black people faster. In the food deserts of many red-lined Black communities where supermarkets are scarce, cheap, sugary processed foods fill the shelves of convenience stores and the bellies of Black shoppers. African Americans are overrepresented in the national figures on obesity. Diabetes rates among Black men and women are nearly 1.5 times those of white men and women. One of the great ironies of sugar's history in the United States is that the brutal work of the enslaved created an industry whose success in producing unhealthy food for mass consumption has taken its greatest toll on Black communities today. None of this was in any way foreordained or even predictable. For thousands of years, sugarcane was a heavy and unwieldy crop that had to be cut by hand and immediately ground to release the juice inside. Otherwise, it would spoil within a day or two. Even before harvest time, rows had to be dug, stalks planted, and plentiful wood chopped as fuel for boiling the liquid and reducing it to crystals and molasses. From the earliest traces of cane domestication on the Pacific island of New Guinea 10,000 years ago, to its island-hopping advance to ancient India in 350 BC, sugar was locally consumed and remained little more than an exotic spice, medicinal glaze, or sweetener for elite palates. This was in part because it was incredibly labor-intensive to produce. To achieve scale for export and trade, cane required tremendous coerced and coordinated human labor in warm climates and on fertile land. Arab enslavers from as far back as the 8th century are credited with spreading sugar plantations throughout the Mediterranean basin of southern Europe and North Africa, Sicily, Cyprus, Malta, Spain, and Morocco, as Muslim rulers conquered parts of the region over the next two centuries. Sugar, we are told, followed the Quran, wrote the late anthropologist Sidney Mintz. As sugar spread in Europe in the Renaissance period, its high price marked it as a luxury good and a symbol of wealth, often in the form of sugar replicas of monumental castles, animals, and other self-aggrandizing objects fancied by nobles. It was after Christopher Columbus's second voyage across the Atlantic Ocean in 1493, bringing sugarcane stalks with him from the Spanish Canary Islands, that everything changed. By then, Spain and Portugal had already begun to put enslaved Africans to work growing sugarcane on the Atlantic islands off the coast of North Africa, and the potential for an industry based on forced labor, fertile land, and a dawning era of global trade had reached an inflection point. Mark Aronson and Marina Budos write in their book Sugar Changed the World, "The true age of sugar had begun, and it was doing more to reshape the world than any ruler, empire, or war had ever done." Over the next two centuries, on the sugar islands of the Greater Antilles, Saint-Domingue, Cuba, and Puerto Rico, among others, and the mainlands of Mexico and Brazil, European powers destroyed countless indigenous lives as colonists staked out vast agricultural operations on their land and enslaved millions of Africans to work the fields. By the mid-17th century, in this already established Atlantic world, the British would stake a claim to the sugar islands of Barbados and Jamaica and the North American colonies. Soon, they came to dominate the international slave trade, too. Although England first established trading posts for acquiring gold and ivory along a span of 5,000 coastal Atlantic miles from present-day Morocco to South Africa by 1672, King Charles II had conferred a monopoly on the Royal African Company specifically for the slave trade. The company used military personnel, government agents, and private investment capital garnered by selling stock to merchants to build the single most successful transatlantic slave trading institution in history. Ships traveled a sea route that in its simplest form resembled an isosceles triangle. The voyage typically started with Royal African ships departing from Bristol, Liverpool, or London, heading to Africa carrying rum, guns, iron bars, fetters, glass beads, clothes, and copper pots to trade for people. Those ships would arrive, for example, in Cape Coast Castle in present-day Ghana, Britain's West African slaving capital, where they would load African captives. With their human cargo, they would sail across the Atlantic. This became known as the Middle Passage, since it was the middle leg of the triangular route. Arriving in Barbados or Jamaica, the ships would exchange people for sugar, molasses, and lumber. From there, they would return home to England, completing the last part of the triangle. Other forms of this triangular route existed, with stops in the North American colonies to load rice, tobacco, flour, and rum, but the crucial leg of the journey was the Middle Passage. Without African lives as the human raw materials in the making of sugar, along with other wealth-producing plantation commodities, tobacco, rice, indigo, and cotton, the distribution of Atlantic peoples and the wealth of the world would likely be very different today. From finance to finished goods, the transatlantic trade spawned a dizzying array of British businesses, manufacturing ships and armaments, glass and iron, linens and pottery, and distilling rum and beer, which would be sold in Africa, the West Indies, and North America, as well as at home in the British Isles. Are we not indebted to that valuable people, the Africans, for our sugars, tobaccos, rice, rum, and all other plantation produce? Asked Malachy Postlethwaite, a London merchant, member of the Royal African Company, and author of The African Trade, the great pillar and support of the British plantation trade in America, published in 1745. The more Negroes imported, he wrote, the more British goods were made and exported for trade. The Negro trade, he emphasized, was the foundation of an inexhaustible fund of wealth and naval power to this nation. Postlethwaite's bullish report was backed by solid evidence. In its first decade, the Royal African Company of England rapidly increased its share of the trade from one-third to three-quarters of the market. During the 1750s, England became the, quote, supreme slaving nation in the Atlantic world, write historians James Raleigh and Stephen D. Barrett. In Bristol, England, a local analyst writing about the 18th century noted, there is not a brick in the city but what is cemented with the blood of a slave. And that blood was spilled more than anywhere else in the production of sugar. As production grew and the market increased, the craze for the sweetener gradually trickled down from elites to the laboring poor. By 1850, sweetened tea, the combination of East and West Indian imports of tea and sugar, was a stimulant, calorie boost, and hot meal substitute for English men, who were working more and more in city factories than on country farms. The increasing supply from sugar plantations lowered the cost and made cheap sugar the single most important addition to the British working class diet during the 19th century, according to Sidney Mintz. The voracious appetite for wealth creation and the unyielding desire for sugar combined to create the foundation of the modern world. From the first time Royal African Company slavers set sail for North America, through the years of the American Revolution, until the abolition of the international slave trade in 1808, roughly 3 million souls, many of them forever branded with the company's initials, RAC, on their bodies, would be forcibly removed from their homes, their kin, and their way of life, the majority of them to feed demand for a sweetener. Countless fortunes were made. In Liverpool, the Martin's Bank Building opened in 1932, and the former home of Barclays memorialized the role of banks in financing the trade with a relief sculpture of two African boys fettered about the neck and ankles and holding bags of money. The slave trade was complex and evolved out of existing networks of exchange indigenous to Africa. Before European slavers arrived, African chiefs and merchants were already trading among themselves along well-established routes from west to east, from the Saharan north to the sub-Saharan south, and all points in between. In addition to trading palm cloth, copper jewelry, ivory ornaments, cutlery, wood, and musical instruments, merchants would exchange enslaved people, captured in wars or village raids. Like elsewhere in the world, a ready system of servitude already existed, writes historian Shawande Mustakeem, the author of Slavery at Sea. European traders came as business partners in what she calls, quote, the human manufacturing process, which consisted of three violent stages of preconditioning, capture, transport, and delivery, for the brutalities of work awaiting them on faraway sugar plantations. African elites did not typically sell their own kin. Captives tended to be culturally and ethnically alien to those who enslaved them, writes the historian James Campbell, the author of Middle Passages, African American Journeys to Africa, 1787 to 2005. About half the captives were prisoners of war, according to Raleigh and Barrett. Another third were people labeled as criminals, undesirables, or outcasts, and treated with disdain, similar to how the English regarded indentured servants forcibly shipped to their North American colonies and Australia in the 17th and 18th centuries. The 20% remaining, Raleigh and Barrett estimate, were victims of kidnapping. But some historians think that the kidnapping number is much higher. Mustakeem cites 70% for the proportion of purchased slaves, who by the 18th century had been snatched from their homes and communities before being removed by sea. Certainly from the perspective of many of the men, women, and children who were put in the holds of slave vessels, The technical definition of kidnapping was a difference without distinction. Few non-elites were spared. One example recorded in the testimony given to the British Parliament's House of Commons in the late 1700s gives a sense of the violence of the enterprise. Off the coast of Bonny Point in present-day Nigeria, a young woman was grabbed by two men who secured her hands behind her back, beat her, and ill-used her on account of the resistance she made, according to testimony given by John Douglas, a slave trader. Traders routinely tore families asunder as they captured and stole people away from mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters. Even some African traders ended up in fetters because of the treachery of it all. One measure of the horrors of kidnapping captives is evidenced by the British Parliament outlawing it in 1750. After being captured or sold, individuals were dragged to barracks where they often lived for months. Some of them died there before slavers loaded them onto ships, one batch of bodies at a time. The transport phase of the human manufacturing process lasted anywhere from 3 to 5 weeks, depending on whether a ship was traveling to Barbados, Jamaica, or New England. Slavers who had originated in Bristol or Liverpool carried, during the peak years, an average of 356 captives on board. Strong, healthy African men in their prime, between 15 and 25 years old, made up the bulk of the enslaved at sea. Planters preferred adult males for work in sugar cultivation, Raleigh and Barrett write, and particularly favored men from Guinea, who were perceived to be docile and agreeable. Ship captains aimed for a 2-to-1 ratio of men to women, with a small percentage of boys and girls. Traders judged women's fitness by their reproductive potential, just as horse breeders might judge the qualities of a brood mare. In the House of Lords records of certificate of slaves taken on board ships, one merchant recorded, quote, "The women in general having good breasts were strong and well." Slavery at sea, as historians have long written, brought terrors to the captives beyond our worst nightmares. The extreme challenges of food preservation and water rationing made the transoceanic journey itself treacherous. The economics of the trade and financial incentives for captains and ship surgeons conspired to keep alive as many captives as possible. But there were limits, starting with space. The surgeon Alexander Falconbridge described conditions aboard his ship where captives, quote, "had not so much room as a man in his coffin, neither in length or breadth, and it was impossible for them to turn or shift with any degree of ease," end quote. Captain John Ashley testified before the members of the House of Commons that he frequently heard them crying out when below for the want of air. Suffocating as if buried alive with human waste uncontainable, men were shackled side by side as metal and iron tore into flesh with every jolt of the ocean. Mustakim found a report in the archives of several men on the Venus who died from, quote, "part of the scrotum torn off with their irons." Slave crews typically separated men from women, leaving women in their own quarters unchained and unprotected, all the easier for sailors to rape them. John Newton, a slave trader turned abolitionist who wrote the hymn Amazing Grace, described this in his memoir. "They are often exposed to the wanton rudeness of white savages." Another ship's crew referred to the area where women were held as the whorehole. Instances of sexual violation on these voyages are impossible to count definitively, but from ship logs, journals, and testimonies, it is evident that they were numerous. On the British vessel African in 1753, William Cooney raped a pregnant woman. She was listed in the log as number 83, following a common practice for a kind of dead naming of captives. He took her, quote, "into the room and lay with her, brute-like, in view of the whole quarter deck." In these moments, slave traders were conditioning Africans for plantation slavery. But the captives were also forming a new identity, a diasporic blackness forged out of their collective fate as they found strength in one another with every miserable day that passed. Uprisings of captives at sea were rare, but were the most spectacular instances of collective resistance. A 1731 insurrection involved 140 Africans. They killed most of the crew and escaped with the ship. Much more frequent acts of resistance took the form of recalcitrance, a refusal by captives to eat or to exercise. They plotted conspiracies to poison the crew's food and beverage, and they also took complete control of their individual bodies and minds when they sought freedom in another realm. The surgeon, Isaac Wilson, recalled a man who threw himself into the sea and seemed to relish his own drowning. He, quote, went down as if exulting that he got away, the physician remembered. On the Middle Passage, mortality rates ranged from 5 to 20%, lowering as the centuries passed. Africans died most often from diseases, including scurvy, an acute vitamin C deficiency, smallpox, pneumonia, and tapeworms. The flux, or dysentery, the most common cause of death, produced its own slow torture of blood-soaked diarrhea and incessant vomiting, triggered by a bacterial infection from contaminated food or water. By the time captives became enslaved on the other side, they had experienced layered cycles of violent deprivation and death, Mustakim writes, seasoned by the terrorizing dynamics of shipboard captivity. American slavers were the last to enter the trade, but from the ports of Rhode Island, beginning in 1709 and lasting officially to 1807, Rhode Islanders managed to make nearly 1,000 voyages to Africa, procuring 106,544 enslaved people. Illegal trafficking continued for decades. Alongside the triangular trade, American colonists opened direct lines of trade that didn't resemble a triangle at all. They traded directly with England, delivering mainland commodities produced by enslaved labor, such as rice, tobacco, and cotton, as well as flour and lumber, and returned home with manufactured goods and luxury items. On separate voyages, American colonists also exported North Atlantic dried cod, flour, and pine wood to plantations in the British West Indies in exchange for sugar and molasses. Molasses was a key part of the sugar trade. It is made during the boiling stage of sugar production, when the cane juice is heated in huge kettles until sugar crystals begin to form as a result of evaporation. This granulation process is repeated several times, producing more crystals, which are filtered out or collected by a strainer. What is left behind is a thicker and thicker concentrate of liquid residue, which becomes molasses. Sugar was incredibly profitable, but molasses became an indispensable exchange commodity too. It was crucial to the manufacturing of desserts, sweet rolls and buns, and other processed foods. It was also the key ingredient in the making of rum. And rum was the lubricant that helped make the international slave trade run like a well-oiled machine. Americans excelled at fermenting and distilling molasses to make millions of gallons of rum, which American-built slave ships, often called rum vessels, brought to West Africa, among other places, to trade for African captives. Aside from being an essential naval ration in the age of sail, rum, according to historian Eric Williams in Capitalism and Slavery, was an essential part of the cargo of the slave ship, particularly the colonial American slave ship. It was profitable to spread a taste for liquor on the coast. The Negro dealers were plied with it, were induced to drink till they lost their reason, and then the bargain was struck. The New England colonies led by Rhode Island operated several distilleries, which produced millions of gallons of rum and brought huge fortunes to white Americans. 8 years before the Boston Tea Party, colonists took part in a lesser-known Rhode Island revolt against the Sugar Act of 1764, which dramatically increased enforcement of duties collected on imported sugar and molasses. Rhode Islanders had avoided paying these taxes by illegally smuggling in molasses for their lucrative rum business from cheaper French West Indian suppliers, bypassing the British West Indies. On April 7, 1765, a group of men blackened their faces to disguise themselves as Native Americans and seized the cargo of the Polly, which included barrel after barrel of molasses from the Sugar Islands, write Aronson and Budos. John Adams observed that the British Parliament had gone too far with its revenue scheme. "Molasses was an essential ingredient of American independence," Adams would later write. Though Britain's North American colonies participated extensively in the sugar trade, the climate of these regions favored other crops such as tobacco, indigo, rice, and cotton. Americans today tend not to think of sugar as the primary crop of slavery, in part because production was mostly limited to the West Indies, colonies held by Spain, Britain, and France that did not ultimately become part of the United States. The main exception to this is Louisiana, which was occupied by the French until 1803. In New Orleans, in 1751, French Jesuit priests planted the first cane stalks in the area, near Barone Street. In the Gulf region of southern Louisiana, weather conditions were more like those in the Caribbean, a geographic space the historian Matthew Gutterill called the American Mediterranean. Given the city's tropical climate, the plant thrived, which it had failed to do in the British colonies of Georgia and South Carolina. Within a few decades, sugarcane production in Louisiana took root. In 1795, Étienne Duboret, a New Orleans sugar planter, granulated the first sugar crystals in the Louisiana Territory. With the advent of local sugar processing, sugar plantations exploded up and down both banks of the Mississippi River. All of this was possible because of the abundantly rich alluvial soil, combined with the technical mastery of seasoned French and Spanish planters who had come to Louisiana from around the cane-growing basin of the Gulf and the Caribbean, and because of the toil of thousands of enslaved people. Estimates suggest that 20 to 22,000 Africans were captured and brought to Louisiana between 1763 and 1812. Most of them, according to the Louisiana Slave Database, built in the 1990s by the historian Gwendolyn Midlow Hall, had been born in Africa on the coasts of Senegambia, the Bight of Benin, the Bight of Biafra, and West Central Africa. The most common ethnicities were Congo, Mandinga, Mina, Bambara, and Wolof. One of the major contributors to the booming Louisiana sugar industry was the Haitian Revolution. More French planters and their enslaved expert sugar workers poured into Louisiana as Toussaint Louverture and Jean-Jacques Dessalines led a successful revolt in Saint-Domingue to secure independence from France in 1804. For decades, Saint-Domingue had been a top producer of sugar and an especially brutal one, so perhaps it is no surprise that the African descendant inhabitants of that colony became the first enslaved sugar workers to stage a successful insurrection. It was just 1 year before, in 1803, that the Whitney Plantation had become a prosperous sugar operation, under the leadership of Jean-Jacques Heidel, Sr., who had inherited the property from his father, Amboise Heidel. In 1820, Heidel Sr. passed the plantation on to his two sons and eventually to a widowed daughter-in-law, Marie Azélie Heidel, in 1840. Marie, in turn, became one of Louisiana's most successful planters. In the 1840s and 50s, the plantation produced hundreds of thousands of pounds of sugar, peaking in the 1854 to 55 season with 407,000 pounds. According to the Whitney Museum's Director of Research, Ibrahim Asek, the Whitney's sugar output made it one of the most important plantations in Louisiana. The Whitney's economic success contributed to Louisiana's rapid growth in the global sugar trade. By the 1850s, Louisiana planters were producing a quarter of the world's cane sugar supply. During her antebellum reign, Queen Sugar bested King Cotton locally, making Louisiana the second richest state in per capita wealth. According to the historian Richard Follett, in 1840, the state ranked third in banking capital behind New York and Massachusetts. The value of enslaved people alone represented tens of millions of dollars in capital that financed investments, loans, and businesses. Much of that investment funneled back into the sugar mills, the most industrialized sector of Southern agriculture, Follett writes. No other agricultural region came close to the amount of capital investment in farming by the eve of the Civil War. In 1853, Representative Miles Taylor of Louisiana bragged that his state's success was, quote, without parallel in the United States, or indeed in the world in any branch of industry. None of this growth was possible without trafficking in human lives. Or, to put it in the words of the U.S. Commissioner of Agriculture in 1867, land without labor was worthless. After the official end of the international slave trade as of January 1, 1808, the domestic trade from the Upper South to the Lower South exploded, while traffic continued on the Atlantic. As a result, Louisiana's enslaved population soared, quadrupling over a 20-year period to 125,000 souls in the mid-19th century. New Orleans became the Walmart of people selling. The number of enslaved labor crews on its sugar plantations doubled, and in every sugar parish, black people outnumbered white. These were some of the most skilled laborers doing some of the most dangerous agricultural and industrial work in the United States. Some enslaved workers mastered the technical skills of distillation, turning cane juice into raw sugar and molasses under intense time pressure to ensure no spoilage and maximum yields. In the mills, alongside adults, children toiled like factory workers, with assembly line precision and discipline, under the constant threat of boiling hot kettles, open furnaces, and grinding rollers. The freeborn upstate New Yorker Solomon Northup, in 12 Years a Slave, his 1853 memoir of being kidnapped while visiting Washington, D.C., and forced into slavery on Louisiana plantations, wrote, "All along the endless carrier are ranged slave children, whose business it is to place the cane upon it when it is conveyed through the shed into the main building." To achieve the highest efficiency, sugar houses operated night and day. On cane plantations in sugar time, there is no distinction as to the days of the week, Northrop wrote. Fatigue might mean losing an arm to the grinding rollers or being flayed for failing to keep up. Enslavers often met resistance with sadistic cruelty. A formerly enslaved black woman named Mrs. Webb described a torture chamber used by her enslaver, Vincent Marmillon. Quote, "One of his cruelties was to place a disobedient slave standing in a box in which there were nails placed in such a manner that the poor creature was unable to move," she told a WPA interviewer in 1940. "He was powerless even to chase the flies or sometimes ants crawling on some parts of his body." Louisiana led the nation in destroying the lives of black people in the name of economic efficiency. The historian Michael Tadman found that Louisiana sugar parishes had a pattern of deaths greatly exceeding births. In a study published by Tadman in the American Historical Review in 2000, he wrote, "Backbreaking labor and inadequate net nutrition meant that enslaved people working on sugar plantations were, compared with other working-age enslaved people in the United States, far less able to resist the common and life-threatening diseases of dirt and poverty." Life expectancy was lower than on a cotton plantation and closer to that of a Jamaican cane field, where the most overworked and abused could drop dead after 7 years of labor. Nevertheless, some enslaved sugar workers managed to fight back. In 1811, in the German coast area near the Whitney Plantation, as many as 500 sugar rebels joined a liberation army heading toward New Orleans, one of the largest revolts of enslaved people in United States history. They were soon cut down, by federal troops and local militia. No record of their actual plan survives. About 100 were killed in battle or executed later. Many of their heads were severed and placed on pikes throughout the region. There were nearly twice as many executions as there were during Nat Turner's more well-known 1831 rebellion, according to historians' estimates. There are no oral histories from the Whitney Plantation to preserve the firsthand testimonies of those who experienced the harsh brutalities of life there. The museum's archived inventory records of enslaved people at the time of Marie Azalee Hadel's passing in 1860, on the eve of the Civil War, suggest that the enslavers systematically sold children for profit, severing offspring from parents. According to Ashley Rogers, the Whitney's executive director, of the 101 people counted, most were adult men, several were Creole-identified women, and 32 were young children, who could not be sold under Louisiana law unless accompanied by their mothers. She told me there were no children older than 10 years. None. America's sugar slavery ended in 1865. But by that time, sugar was a staple product everywhere in the world. After the Civil War, black people sought to build lives on their own terms, and in the decades that followed, U.S. sugar plantations reorganized themselves around the labor of free black workers. Though many black Louisianans found that the crushing work with sugarcane remained mostly the same, during the early days of Reconstruction, black political organizing in the form of union leagues swept the sugar region, along with the rest of the South. Given the large black populations in these areas, freedmen made significant gains overnight, electing black state officials and inspiring economic changes and labor organizing on sugar plantations. Agents from the Freedmen's Bureau, the federal agency responsible for ensuring black people's safety and welfare following the war, often noted in their reports that planters frequently complained that when they dismissed one worker, the others, quote, would immediately quit work and threaten to leave the place. As new wage earners, black sugar workers acting in solidarity negotiated the best terms they could, signed labor contracts for up to a year, and moved from one plantation to another in search of a life whose daily rhythms beat differently than before. But the gains of Reconstruction were short-lived. As W.E.B. Du Bois so eloquently wrote in his 1935 book, Black Reconstruction in America, 1860 to 1880, quote, the slave went free, stood a brief moment in the sun, then moved back again toward slavery. The domestic terrorism that ended Reconstruction and destroyed so many black lives was particularly vicious in the sugar region. Striking sugar workers were often met with swift and violent reprisals. In November 1887, a decade after former Confederates had regained political control of the South and had terrorized and purged much of Louisiana's black political leadership from office, a national union attempted to organize sugar workers. In three parishes during harvest season, workers had downed their tools, walked off the job, and insisted on higher wages paid in cash rather than plantation credit, writes Follett. Strike breakers and state militiamen responded with a show of force. Shots rang out, and at least 30 black people, some sources estimated hundreds, were killed in their homes and on the streets of Thibodeau, Louisiana. A local white planter's widow, Mary Pugh, wrote of this moment, rejoicing to her son, quote, I think this will settle the question of who is to rule, the nigger or the white man, for the next 50 years. Sugar enslavers never lost their grip on the land. Compared with black sharecropping on cotton plantations, where African Americans gained a small measure of physical independence as individual family units living and working on white-owned land, black cane workers had little choice but to live in somebody's old slave quarters. As had been the case for centuries, making cane into sugar required access to huge swaths of land, large amounts of capital, and gang labor to plant, harvest, and mill the crop. In spite of the substantial barriers of capital and racism, African Americans nevertheless aspired to own sugarcane farms or rent them from white owners. A small number of black sugar farmers inherited land from their antebellum free black ancestors or accumulated property on their own. But they faced discrimination at every turn and the threat of violence if their success challenged the Jim Crow racial order. The historian Rebecca Scott found that although, quote, black farmers were occasionally able to buy plots of cane land from bankrupt estates or otherwise establish themselves as suppliers, the trend was for planters to seek to establish relations with white tenants or sharecroppers who could provide cane for the mill, end quote. And if black sugarcane farmers succeeded in the face of all these obstacles, they still had to face racist actions by government agencies, banks, and real estate developers who conspired to take their land. Mechanization made matters worse by rewarding large-scale farming and shrinking the number of jobs. Increasingly, only poorly paid seasonal work remained. By World War II, many black people in the sugar-growing regions sought opportunity and autonomy elsewhere, moving from the cane fields in Louisiana to car factories in the North. Today, the number of black sugar farmers in Louisiana is likely in the single digits. The Mississippi River is, and always has been, the lifeblood of the region, nurturing the southern Louisiana soil and linking this place to a many-centuries-old Atlantic market in sugar and the enslaved. It bears witness to all that has happened here, the human beings stolen, shipped, and sold on plantations, the harsh realities of lives cut short by sugar. The road that leaves the Whitney Plantation follows the river, which snakes along just beyond the grass-covered levees. On most days, there's not much traffic. The land is quiet and sun-drenched, with round hay bales that lie like small animals resting peacefully atop the grass. There is something idyllic about the landscape, but there is nothing innocent about the history of this place, where human beings corrupted nature to do great harm to humanity. Though black labor no longer plays a big role in producing sugar, sugar still plays a big role in the lives of black people. Among all Americans, added sugar has been linked to growing rates of certain chronic illnesses, including those from which black people suffer the most. African Americans are more likely to eat poorer quality processed foods with high amounts of added sugars. In 2013, public health researchers at Johns Hopkins University used the U.S. Census and InfoUSA food store data to analyze supermarket availability by census tract. As poverty increased, the number of supermarkets decreased, but the prevalence of junk food-stocked convenience stores increased. And when poverty was held constant, the researchers found black communities still had the fewest supermarkets. In a 2015 study of healthful food availability in Topeka, Kansas, researchers at Kansas State University found that even low-income white neighborhoods were twice as likely to have a food store as black ones. The researchers concluded, quote, "Food deserts and food insecurity are perhaps the most important deleterious consequence of residential segregation in the United States. The scarcity of healthful food options in black neighborhoods is offset by the abundance of bad ones." Recent nutritional surveys by the National Center for Health Statistics found that among children, adolescents, and adults, black people consume a higher percentage of their daily calories from fast food than do Hispanic and white people. In addition, certain food companies have targeted black youths with advertising. A marketing analysis of television advertising dollars found a 50% increase between 2013 and 2017 in ads for sweetened food and beverages and snacks aimed at black households. Shiriki Kumanyika, a co-author of the study and the chair of Drexel University's Council on Black Health, said of the findings, "At best, these advertising patterns imply that food companies view black consumers as interested in candy, sugary drinks, fast food, and snacks with a lot of salt, fat, or sugar, but not in healthier foods." Since sugar came to these shores, there hasn't been a time when black people weren't getting the short end of the cane stalk. From plantation to farm to table, African Americans have always paid the highest costs for sugar cultivation.